We're going to close out the show this morning with Joe Clement talking with MK. They'll be discussing a variety of heady topics that are surrounding our current housing system and issues that related to that old capitalism. Joe?
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today by MK. If you listen to Paul Roland's Wednesday Talk Radio when he's not on, you sometimes might hear MK and other folks from the Portland Assembly come on to talk about different political and social issues. And I've asked MK to come on today to kind of continue a conversation they started the other day about false narratives in our housing system and really the idea of artificial scarcity and how that has come to play in the different housing crises that we experience. Thanks for coming on the show, MK.
Thanks for having me.
In a nutshell, what we are going to talk about is how there are these narratives in the media that are promulgated by officials and by people who stand at the head of different kinds of companies that own big real estate holdings that have to do with why the rents are going up, why there's houseless people on the streets, even though we see housing going empty around us. And how is that the case? Where do we really need to start to kind of wrap our heads around that situation?
Yeah, I think the best place to start in unpacking the false narrative is this two competing messages. One, as you said, is one of scarcity and shortage. And also then by setting that precedent says, and this is why there is a crisis of affordability. It's because of shortage. That narrative, in essence, tells people, don't believe your eyes. Don't believe your lived experience. Don't believe the lived experience of your friends and families that have been getting double-digit rent increases and priced out, because it's not complicated. It's just simple. There's a shortage. Versus the sort of truer narrative, which doesn't necessarily have much to do with aggregate supply. It has to do with supply that people can afford, not just what's being built, but also what is being erased. We've had sort of a slow rise in acquisitions, lots of money coming in and buying up existing unsubsidized, unprotected, low-income, affordable housing, and then sort of ratcheting that up to a fever pitch that then was the genesis of Renter SOS and a declared housing state of emergency. That declared housing state of emergency was predicated on double-digit rent increases and all of a sudden people not being able to afford to stay in their homes. That was not about saying, well, gosh, there's just not affordable places for people to move into. And it was also that rents were going up. So those two dueling narratives. Is there a shortage? Is that why there is a crisis? Or is the crisis of affordability rooted in something other than just simple economics 101?
If you've been reading the newspapers in the last year or so, you would have seen an article perhaps about how in Portland we have 16 some odd thousand empty units of housing, and the people who need housing the most, who don't have any housing, is only about a fourth of that, 4,000 or 5,000. And that was, you know, brought into the news to like really raise important questions about like, why do we even have a housing crisis? So how is it that we have that mismatch between empty housing and people who don't have housing, and somehow they aren't getting into that housing?
I would say first that one construct creates that effect. So those two things, I think intuitively we know that those things are related. And yet a lot of the messages that come to us say, well, we've got a housing crisis here, and then we've got a homeless crisis over here, and then over here in completely unrelated news, let's talk about vacancies. And yet all of this is all related along the continuum. I want to also say, too, that when you were talking about the 16,000 vacant units, that is a bare minimum. That number was calculated based on the American Community Survey, which is sort of census update data that said, well, here's all of the housing units, here's how many are occupied, and that was where that number came from, and that's a bare minimum. The reality, if we had access to the data, to all of it transparently, that's just the tip of the iceberg. But, you know, anecdotally, we see this happening all over the globe. Anywhere that there is a hot rental market, the headlines are everywhere about all of this empty, expensive housing. At the same time, all of these people more and more living on the streets, and everywhere in between, people that are housed are just being housed barely. And so the question about how is it that we came to this place where we have all of this empty housing? One thing to make clear is that this current narrative that says you need to let Wall Street and private developers continue to build more expensive housing because there is a shortage, that narrative is predicated on a myth, a lie, that says that the first housing bubble that began with finance deregulation in 1999 and ended in 2008 with a collapse, a calamity that displaced almost immediately by virtue of the foreclosure crisis, you know, all told 10 million plus people, that bubble also created a vast surplus. A Fed study, a New York Fed study, estimated in 2012 at least 3.5 million in vacant surplus housing. And that's beyond the normal buffer zone that accounts for growth. And so how we came about now to also be in this place where we have a lot of vacant high-priced units is it has to do with financialization. And to oversimplify it, housing, once the mortgage debt has been financialized and traded on Wall Street, it's completely divorced from its social utility. And all of this housing and securitized debt, we also are now in an era of rent-backed mortgage securities. So it's a perpetuation of that same calamity, except on a denser scale. And housing then just becomes not only divorced from its social utility, meaning it's not being built because people need to live in it. It is based on satisfying the demand for high-yield commodities. And that commodity is mortgage debt. And the supply that's needed is more mortgage debt, not necessarily places that people need to live in. And obviously, market rate right now is about 120% of median family income. So it's vastly outside of the range of what the majority of people can afford. And it's proliferating not because there's demand to live in it, but there is a demand for trading in that debt because it is highly, highly profitable on Wall Street.
You made it clear that to really kind of understand where we are today, we have to go back to what happened in the 2008 crash, yeah, and how after those 10 some odd million people were pushed out of their homes, the different institutions that owned those homes were able to then buy those homes back. That when the banks were bailed out, that money didn't go into making the economy work for people. It went into making sure that the banks stayed afloat. And they did that by buying back their own houses.
So the bailout gave trillions of dollars to the same private equity giants who manufactured that disaster and who profited exponentially at that pivot point in that arc of a bubble. So it was constructed not only to create windfall profits, but when the government gave public money, all of those trillions went to Wall Street. None of it actually entered the real economy. Had it entered the real economy, had trillions of dollars been injected into the real economy to help distressed homeowners stay in their homes, we would also have some inflation. We don't have inflation because trillions went straight to private equity. And yes, what they did then with public money is they then were able to, after the big fish ate the little fish, they were then able to take that money and buy up all of those on paper worthless mortgages that had been bundled together after the collapse, and were able to buy all of that stuff back in bulk for pennies on the dollar and then hoard it. That's the other thing that the Fed study also found, is that between 2000 I think 2010 and 2012, all of that surplus was consumed. We kind of already know that, but that it was also withheld off of the market. So the big fish, namely Blackstone, purchased up all of those distressed assets, meaning that they weren't, they were no longer valuable on the Wall Street market, bought them up. And then once those hit their books, they were revaluated at market. So all of a sudden, worth billions again on the paper. And then they held it off the market. And then they turned them into rental properties. And then in 2012, they created rent-backed mortgage securities. And here we go again.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking with MK about false narratives in the housing system. So how does that dynamic translate to the ever-increasing rents that we've been talking about for the last almost as long as that's happened?
Creating a crisis of affordability, particularly when now you're trading in rent-backed mortgage securities, there is motivation not only to create the constraints whereby you're able to extract higher and higher rents. That's that point at which developers will be willing to build those artifacts that create that debt is when it's called a strike price, is when the value is such that they can then say, okay, now I can demand this much in rent in order to actually get that built. And so that also has sort of a bleeding effect just by virtue of the way that real estate operates. It's based on proximity. So if you have a tenement next to a brand new high density, empty, high priced development, and market rate is now, you know, $1,900 for a studio apartment, the rents are going to go up, because that's just how sort of like property managers, they're always looking around for comparables and saying, well, hey, now market rate is now this. And so it also ratchets up those rents, even for those for those who aren't directly involved in the financialization part. And then we also have acquisitions. So not just that new debt, but just in under 4 years, Wall Street giants, Blackstone, Goldman Sachs, Starwood Capital, big names have been in here in the Portland metro area just in under 4 years, spending over $6 billion acquiring existing lower income, naturally affordable units. And then what that does is they recapitalize that old debt and create new debt out of it. So two prongs, all of those people, now those rents are at market rate, and all of that new debt goes right back into those bundled securities, where it then is able to be traded over and over again as an abstract on Wall Street to conjure even more trillions as a bona fide commodity.
And so the value that is being created or traded doesn't have to do with the housing itself. It has to do with basically tokens to play this trading game that, you know, you have to be putting up millions or billions of dollars to like get in on. And that, you know, it doesn't even really matter about people paying rents or mortgages. It has to do with investors. It has to do with getting people to go ahead and buy financialized debt. And in a weird way, like it's a fool's game, and it's predicated on finding ever more foolish people.
Yeah, it's one of those things that large private equity always hedges its bets and doesn't like surprises. And also the first housing market collapse allowed that game to be even more finely calibrated. And it is, as you say, a fool's game in terms of speculation. There's all different sort of range of speculators. There's those that get in first, which is large global private equity. They get in order to actually get the stuff built on a massive scale and to create those bonds and enter that market at that price. And then as that trajectory, then you have people that are entering late saying, hey, everybody's winning at the table, I guess I'll invest. And then sort of at the apex of that, The large players start to pivot, because it's designed to sort of generate modest profits when things are still ratcheting up, but even greater windfall profits and more monopolization when, you know, as we saw in the first crash, when everybody else is sort of scrambling to cover their bets and losing. So it is a fool's game, and the top of that part where it starts to pivot into something that is inevitably going to be catastrophic is when there's no greater fool for those speculators to sort of flip that paper, once it's appreciated, it'll start to cool when it's oversupplied and overvalued. And that tipping point then accelerates the downfall even further.
But the big takeaway is that we have an abundance of housing, both locally and nationally. Some places don't, but nationally we do, and some places locally have abundance. And our experience with this fool's game, it should point to a solution, but it socially, collectively, don't really have a good one.
Well, I think part of getting to a point where we're all on the same page about the solution, and getting all on the same page about the actual problem and the root of that actual problem is made difficult by this sort of really hard sell neoliberal phrasing. And so it's difficult to unpack when there is so much language and so much calibrated sort of like studied, you know, these folks that are studying cognitive linguistics that are saying use that word and don't use that word and cue up shortage thinking and telling people how to create a value sandwich to say take a little bit of data and then sandwich it in between all of this rhetoric that plays to emotion, that plays to cognitive bias. And so I think that there's, especially on the left, I think we all have ideas about solutions in general. But attacking this sort of head on and getting all on the same page means that we all sort of have to confront how inoculated are we against this particularly insidious neoliberal framework that is constantly playing, especially to people on the left. I mean, that's what neoliberalism is. That's why it's wrapped in all of that. And it is designed to be confusing. And so when we get to solutions and we say, well, it doesn't really ring as true, and I'm not really supply side and like all this market rate, but what else do we have? And I don't really have anything in my toolkit that allows me to clearly be able to call that out as false, and not only as false just because we agree to disagree, but inherently disingenuous and intentionally manipulative. That's the place we need to get to, and that's really muddy.
And I mean, that is where we almost got to collectively during the Occupy movement, and the bankers and the housing speculators were all called out on this. And there was, for a time, a national demand, although the occupiers wouldn't make it, around socializing, nationalizing this housing stock that now exists.
And right when we're all still on the scene of the catastrophe, those are really clear moments. Those are really clear moments where you say, this just happened. And Wall Street, you did this. And we see this. And there needs to be accountability. And there needs to be a reckoning. And we don't. You should not ever be able to do this ever again. And that was a really clear moment. And the bailout rewarded that. But at the same time, we were also in the midst of like massive unemployment. And so this is also how these constructs of disaster capitalism, like we can have these really wakeful moments where we demand action and we demand justice, and when we think that that's going to come from Congress, and we're ready and we're mobilized, and then it doesn't come, and instead they get rewarded, and then we're also suffering acutely because people are trying to stay fed and stay housed. There's a lot of really clear and present things that we have to attend to. So I think that's a good reminder that says like that didn't end there. Like that was a housing crisis that we sort of also may have thought that like, well, and then they stopped doing that. Well, they didn't. In fact, they got rewarded with public money, and then they gathered up that surplus and they hoarded it. Then they rented it back to us at a premium. And then they created another financial instrument just like the first, only more nefarious, that was targeted specifically at renters, a much more captive market. And then lo and behold, we have this massive proliferation of this sort of monoculture condo apartment walls that are everywhere. All of these hot rental markets around the globe and the United States and Portland didn't all of a sudden become inundated with massive population, unexpected growth everywhere at the same time. And they're sitting empty because it's the same game. They never got punished. The regulations that came along after that were minimal and only applied to single family mortgage originations, just no punishment, reward. And we're still living this. This is the second wave of that. It didn't stop there, but I think we just had to survive in the meantime.
Part of the problem is collectively, except for that moment during Occupy, we don't have a good way of saying that these actors should not have the right, should be stripped of the right of property, basically, and that we cannot expect anything to be different if we ask them to somehow make the housing system work, because they are not in the business of housing people. They're in the business of all of this fictitious value pumping.
And you're getting to the heart also of this cognitive dissonance, too, that says, like, well, the very same actors who almost broke the world, and even before finance deregulation, you know, like real estate, racial capitalism has always been at the heart of oppression, displacement, and economic violence. And yet somehow now they're going to save us from the disaster that they created if we just roll back regulations and allow them to do more of what they've been doing already.
And that's what the let the developers build narrative is like so hung up on, is first of all, they take for granted that there's a shortage when there's not, but that somehow in order to have our social needs met, we have to satisfy the like anti-social needs of the developers, which have to do with making money.
And that's the cult of the invisible hand that acknowledges and says, well, if you just lean into the virtue of selfishness, then by virtue of its own need to preserve itself, it will have to at least distribute some equity in order to continue doing that. We don't have to try to inject a sense of goodwill into these players. We just have to trust that the invisible hand will eventually, if we satiate the selfishness, that then good things will happen if we suffer well in the meantime.
Yeah, and not only does that not actually work out for us, but it sidesteps the fact that we don't even need to have them build more. I mean, certainly building has to happen in some places, but that the reality that we are not confronting is that we have an oversupply.
There is no housing crisis. There's only an affordable housing crisis, and there is an abundance of aggregate supply. Wealthy people have always had options. And just as a metric in terms of how much oversupply there is, sort of a baseline to keep up with population growth is about like 3,000, 4,000 units a year. In 2017, I believe, 2018, new building unit permits were at like 10,000 just in 1 year. And then in order to avoid having to be subject to inclusionary housing, developers shoved almost 4.5 years worth of construction permits into the final quarter, like something like 19,000 units, so that they could just continue building. So if a baseline is 3,500 to 4,000, and in 1 year they actually delivered 10,000 and they got 19,000 more, you know, in the chamber, that gives you some idea just how out of proportion that avarice is. And so there is a woeful lack of housing that is affordable to the majority of people, not only the stuff that's not getting built, but also the stuff that's getting acquired, billions of dollars coming in to acquire it, to kick those people out, and then to jack those rents up to market.
Well, one thing that we are scarce on is time. So thank you, MK, for coming on and talking about these important and all too confusing topics.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.